this month.
Thank you very much, Tony. Of course, it's a special pleasure to be back here and to be given the chance to talk to you about optimization and physics. So I know that a few of you have heard the wonderful talk by Martin Veit, Introduction to Optimization Problems. So these ones will have a second chance to learn a little bit more, because of course I will have to start by some introduction on optimization problems. And then in the second part of the talk, I will switch to more recent work on satisfiability. And this is work that we developed basically with Zecchina in Trieste and Parisi in Rome. And I have also collaborated with various people on these topics, Braunstein, Biroldi, Franz, Ricci Tersenghi, and Veit. So let me start by a kind of brief introduction to what combinatorial optimization is about. In combinatorial optimization, you are given a set of configurations, and the configuration will be based typically on n discrete variables, like for instance Boolean variable, which can be 0, 1 or something like that, or Ising spins, or this, some set of discrete variables. And you have an energy function. I will use a language which switches between the language of physics and optimization, but you will easily make the connection. So it can be called either a cost function or an energy function, which is defined on this space of configuration. And typically, I will be interested in problems in which the energy can be computed in polynomial time as a function of the number of variables. And then optimization, really, there are three main classes of optimization problem. One in which you want to find the configuration or a configuration which minimizes the energy. There is the evaluation problem, which is a bit simpler, which is, can you find the cost of the optimal configuration? There may exist some problem in which you can find the cost without exhibiting what is a configuration. There are decision problems, which are very important. I will talk a lot about that. Which in a decision problem, one tries to answer a question, a yes or no question, like is there a configuration with an energy less than a given number or not? So, as Tony said in the introduction, optimization problems, they are really ubiquitous. Let me give very briefly a few examples just to give you an idea. Okay, one of the most famous one, because it's so simple to explain, is the traveling salesman problem, in which you are given n points. A configuration is a tour which goes through all the points and comes back to the, where it started. There are n minus 1 factorial over 2 configuration, and the energy is the length. In job assignment, one is given n persons and n jobs, and you have to assign the job to the person depending on the affinity. The energy is given by minus the sum of the affinities. And that's a very practical problem, actually, as you can imagine, even for everyday life. The spin glass problem, imagine that you look at copper manganese, for instance. You have magnetic impurities of manganese diluted in a copper matrix, and then you have the interaction between the spins depend on distance and oscillates with distance. So some of the spins want to point parallel, some of the pairs want to point parallel, other ones want to point anti-parallel. And so if you have just Ising spins, two states per spin, you have 2 to the n configuration, and the energy is a sum of exchange energies, exchange interaction between the spins, and you want to find the configuration of spins with lowest energy. So these are all problems in which there was quite a lot of work also from the physics point of view, well, especially the third one, but also the other two. But I want to focus a bit more on some decision problem, and there are actually quite old problem in decision. This was a problem that people were considering around the 17th century, which is a map of Königsberg with all the bridges. And you have here 7 bridges or something. Yes, 7 bridges. And the question that people wanted to answer is whether it is possible to tour through the city by going once on each bridge and only once and get back home. And this question, actually, it was a question that was that attracted the attention of Euler, And what Euler did is the following. First, he introduced a graph theory for that. Some people said that he was the inventor of graph theory. I don't know if it is true, but in any case, here is a representation of the problem. Here you have the island is a point A, then you have the top place is point C, D, and B, and the red links are the bridges. And so then the problem of finding what now is called an Eulerian circuit is a problem of going through this graph by going one time through each link of the graph and getting back home. And Euler actually solved this problem in 1736. He was able to show that there exists an Eulerian circuit in a graph if and only if every vertex of the graph has even degree. Of course, that it has even degree is a necessary condition. Everybody can see that immediately. It's a bit less trivial to prove that it is a sufficient condition, but that's what he managed to do. So in some sense, it's an easy problem. But it's interesting, first of all, this is a copy, this bad drawing is because it is a copy of a drawing in the paper by Euler, and I find it especially nice from this point of view. And also he has some very nice remarks in the paper in which he says, of course, it would be possible to solve this problem by enumerating all possibilities and so on. But this method, it's not very elegant, but above all, if you have many more bridges, it becomes something which is totally impractical, and you will never get very, very far with this method. So he had already some kind of hints of the complexity, as we will see later on. Another optimization problem that attracted physicists and mathematicians in good old days is Sir Hamilton's Ecosian game. So when he was not working on dynamics, he was also inventing games, and he had prepared a puzzle. And this puzzle, that I think it was even solved, that it was this dodecahedron, and the question is whether it is possible to go through each corner of this dodecahedron exactly once. So in Euler's circuit, you have to go through each edge. In Hamilton's problem, you have to go through each corner, each vertex. And okay, I spare you a little bit of energy, so I give you one answer for this problem. This is a map, a two-dimensional map of the dodecahedron, and this is one solution. So that was 130 years later. And much more recently, there has been a whole field which is called computational complexity, algorithmic complexity, which has come up with a very, very nice classification of optimization problem. And it's, okay, I will not be able to really explain all of it, but let's say a large part of it is based on worst case analysis of decision problems. So I remind you that this decision problem, you have to answer like yes or no, like is there a Hamiltonian circuit in this graph or is there a Eulerian circuit? And this classification, it goes as follows. There are the complexity classes are as follows. There is a first class which is called P. P means polynomial. Polynomial means tractable. It means that there exists an algorithm which is able to solve the problem in a time which grows like a power law in the number of variables. And among all the problems that I have shown to you, assignment can be solved in polynomial time. Eulerian circuit can be solved in polynomial time. I even gave you the algorithm. It just amounts to looking at each vertex and seeing if the degree is even or not. So, I mean, that's clearly something you can do in a time proportional to the number of vertices. If you look at the spin-glass problem in two dimensions, it's also polynomial. The random fieldizing model is polynomial, and actually that is used quite a lot by some colleagues of us in order to do nice simulation of random fieldizing model at zero temperature to find the ground state. Now there is a much broader class which is called NP. NP stands for non-deterministic polynomial. Non-deterministic polynomial, it's a very strange way of phrasing things, but let's say that for us, basically it means that if you have a yes solution, a yes answer, it can be checked in a polynomial time, that it has a short certificate. For instance, if I tell you there is a Hamiltonian path and I give you the Hamiltonian path, you can check that it is so in polynomial time. That's very easy. And so basically for us, it means that these are the problems in which the energy can be computed in polynomial time. And there are, as you imagine, that is a very, very broad class of problems. And so there are now in this class of non-deterministic polynomial problem, the big achievement of computational complexity was to show that there are problems which are the hardest in this class. They are called NP-complete. And NP-complete problems, they are defined as follows. A problem A is NP-complete if all problems which are NP can be reduced to it in polynomial time. Is every problem in which the energy can be computed in polynomial time, I have a polynomial mapping to map it to A. Which means that if by case I would find one problem in NP complete and I would be able to solve it in polynomial time, then the whole class NP would be solvable in polynomial time.
Here, just to clarify, when you say solve, that means find the solution, not just checking the solution.
That means finding the solution.
Yeah. In your definition of NP, you were only checking the solution.
Yes, exactly. So it is not at all obvious that there are problems like that, because you have to show that any problem in NP can be mapped to it. So it's not something that is obvious. And it was a very nice achievement by Cook in 71, who showed the following theorem. He exhibited one problem which is called satisfiability, which is NP complete. And I will talk later on in detail about satisfiability, so you will have a chance to understand why this is the most fundamental problem probably of all this theory. And there are a lot of NP-complete problems, actually, like traveling salesman problem, Hamiltonian cycle. So it's not so easy to guess a priori if I give you a new problem. Guess whether it is P or NP-complete and so on. It's not easy because, for instance, Hamiltonian circuit is NP-complete, Eulerian circuit is polynomial, so I mean it's a bit tricky. Spin glass in dimension larger or equal to 3 is also NP-complete. So now with this nice classification, it turns out that there is a big problem with this classification, and the big problem is this one, that nobody knows whether P is equal to NP or not. And that's considered one of the main challenges in this field. And so the complexity map can have really there are two possibilities for the complexity map. So the one that is widely conjectured is that P is different from NP. So then it means that there are in this whole set of NP problems, the one in which the energy is computed in polynomial time, you have the easy ones which are down there. You have the NP-complete ones, which are up there, and actually one knows that there are some in between also, if P is different from NP. Now, there is also a possibility that P is equal to NP, because nobody has been able to show whether it is the case or not. And in this other case, it would mean that everybody is equivalent here, and everybody is polynomial, actually. So let me turn now to this famous satisfiability problem, which is at the core of this field. And thanks. I will. Okay, there are many examples of satisfiability problem. Being near to Hollywood, I decided to take one about actors. And so this is the example that I choose. A theatrical director feels obligated to cast either his ingenue, actress Alvarez, or his nephew, actor Cohen, in a production. But Miss Alvarez won't be in a play with Cohen, her former lover, and she demands that the cast include her new flame, actor Davenport. The producer, with her own favors to repay, insists that actor Branislavski have a part, but Branislavski won't be in any play with Miss Alvarez or Davenport. Is it possible to satisfy the tangled web of conflicting demands? So that's also from a paper in the New York Times, which means that it must be important. And so let me formalize it a little bit. Here you have n Boolean variables, like for each of the actor, whether he's in the play or not. And then I have a certain number of constraints. And the constraints, actually, they take the form of what is called a clause, which means that it is an or of the variable, like x1 or x27 or x3 negated. This means negated. So some of the variable may be negated, but then I will have some or of the variable. And the question is there a choice of the values of xi in 0, 1 of the Boolean variable such that all constraints are satisfied? I will call that a sat case. And in fact, it means that it's a very, very generic problem, because it means that if it is the case, then I can write a logical statement, which is this one. This is the first clause. I take the end of the first clause, the second clause, and so on, and this must be true. And so, in fact, it's an easy fact to see that any logical statement, you can decompose it that way, as an end of things which are built from the variable and some or between the variable and their negation. It's called conjunctive normal form. So this gives, I mean, I will not certainly try to prove you the Cook theorem, but this gives you a hint of why this problem is crucial. It's because you can write any statement in this form of satisfiability.
Is satisfiability problem the only NP-complete problem known?
No. Oh, there are thousands. I mean, there are at least hundreds, maybe thousands that have been listed. And they have all the problem. The difficult problem was to find the first one,
right?
Because for the first one, you have to show that every problem can be reduced to it. But then finding a second one is easy, because you just have to map the second one to show that it is at least as hard as satisfiability. So that's.
But the NP complete is the worst case, right? If I give you some random.
Yes, I will discuss that right now. Sure.
And about the equivalent analysis, for the worst equivalent analysis, or what does that mean?
NP complete is always for the worst case.
So the worst equivalent analysis is just connections, you decide to make them bad. The JIJs.
Well, of course, if I give you an Edwards Anderson in which the J, I, J are all positive, that's not a difficult problem.
So. Anything that is coupled to,
yes.
What if you speak about solving spin glass, it means finding ground state.
Finding the ground state configuration.
Finding excited state can be more complex.
That's also a different. I mean, okay, there are other complexity classes that I don't want to discuss. I mean, finding the number of configuration at a given, like the computing an entropy and so on. This becomes even more complicated. Here, I'm sticking to the simplest case, which is finding the ground state, let's say, or deciding whether there is a ground state at a low enough energy. So. So this is a beautiful theory, this algorithmic complexity theory, but it's based on a worst case analysis. And in fact, people who have been working experimentally on optimization problems, they know that some examples of this optimization problem, some of them are very easy to solve. And we'll show examples later on. And so in some sense, experimental complexity, it's not so much interested in worst case, but it would like to understand the typical case. And how does one define typical case complexity? That's something that is very open in the field. And in some sense, we physicists, there is a way that we favor. And the way that we favor, the road that we favor, is to introduce a measure, probability measure on instances, on samples. And that we are very used to it. For instance, if I talk about copper manganese at 1% manganese, I know that any measurement that I can do here or in Grenoble or in Saclay, they give me the same thing. Well, more or less, in principle, for the specific heat, for a large sample, and so on and so forth. So it means that I am not discussing what is happening to this sample of copper manganese. I just have a class of dilution. I say 1%. If it has been well prepared, it's always the same. And that's exactly what people have started to discuss in algorithmics also. And for instance, they have decided to introduce a random three-sat problem. What is a random three-sat problem? It's a problem in which you take three variables per clause, and you take the variables at random and negate them at random. So then you can start to do experiments, numerical experiments with that, and see what is the probability. That is, so I have a certain set of n variables. I pick up a clause at random, three numbers at random, I negate the variables at random, that's my first clause. Introduce second clause and so on, I put M constraints, M clause, and then depending on the ratio M divided by N, I will have different behavior. And this I can see numerically. Well, it's very obvious that if M over N, number of constraints per variable, is very small, then it will be very easy to satisfy all constraints, and if it is very large, it will be very difficult. So what does one find? That's exactly what one finds. One finds here plotted the percentage of SAT configuration as a function of the ratio of number of constraints per variable. So this percentage, it's 100% when there are very few constraints. It's zero when there are many constraints. And in between, that's for three SAT, it's around 4.2 or something like that. There is a kind of crossover. And this curve, I have not brought the data, but I mean it has been studied quite well. When you increase the size, the number of variable, this curve becomes sharper and sharper. And so there is what people call a threshold phenomenon. Actually, computer scientists have adopted the name phase transition. So it's a phase transition that is seen in this problem. And what is very interesting is that this phase transition is correlated with the complexity, the typical complexity. Because if I look at the computer time, I have it's an NP-complete problem. There is no very, very good algorithm, but taking the best available algorithm, people look at the computer time to solve the problem. And they find that the computer time here is typically very small because basically when there are very few constraints, you just take variables at random and it's okay. So, I mean, you don't need much time. And here it's also small because you have many constraints and you easily find some contradiction. And the region in which it is difficult is in between it's around the phase transition. Yes?
What about the worst case scenario?
What about?
Computer time, at least qualitatively, how it should look.
For the worst case?
Yeah.
But the worst case, it does not mean...
If you will choose among your...
If I take the sample, yeah, okay, I see what you mean. The problem is that if I sit... Okay, I think this has not been studied, but it has not been studied for a very good reason. It is that the samples that you would like to study are exponentially rare. So you would have to do really very, very heavy simulations to do
but
such a thing.
But it also means that there are several asymptotes.
Yes, of course.
Very typical,
of
not
course.
Typical, but still...
Of course, of course, of course. That is, of course, there are easy samples here, but they are very rare, and yes.
So this, the percentage that is satisfied is not like a conventional order parameter in a magnet because it's either 100% or zero.
Yes, it goes to a sharp transition. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But not only is it a sharp transition, but in the satisfied state, it's 100%.
Yes, but there could be one continuous parameter which one could plot, and which it has been done actually, is to compute the minimal number of violated clause. Okay, minimal number of violated constraints. And this would be zero all this phase, and then start from zero continuously here. This one would be, so it's like, it's what
yeah,
we,
like
it's, it would be what we, it would be exactly the ground state energy. Ground state energy here is zero because there is no violation of any constraint, and then it starts from zero. So what is interesting is that if you increase the size, this blue curve becomes sharper and sharper, and the computer time, it jumps a lot, it increases a lot as n increases, but in the region of the phase transition. So that's the region where it increases exponentially. So basically, this numerical message is that for this problem, there is a threshold phenomenon in a region alpha c around 4.25, 4.26. And this has been studied quite a lot by many people. And then there have also been interesting mathematical work on that. And for instance, Friedgut has been able to show that the percentage of satisfiable sample, the blue curve, becomes sharper and sharper as n increases. But nobody has been able really to prove that it converges to a value, but there are some bounds, upper bounds and lower bounds, which are around 4.4 or something for the upper bounds, 3. Something for the lower bound.
And now here's the three-set problem.
Yes.
A similar behavior for three sets.
Okay. Yes, this I should have said. It turns out that if you fix the size of the clause, two sat is polynomial. 3 sat is NP-complete, and any number above 3 is NP-complete. So 3 sat is the first NP-complete case. So that's why most of the work has been focused on 3 sat, actually. So, as I told you, if we are talking about typical case complexity, then it starts to be a framework in which one can hope to study things with a statistical physics idea. And there are basically two types of questions that I would like to discuss. The first type of question is, what are the properties of a generic sample? That is, if I take a random 3-sat at a fixed value alpha equals 4, 4 constraints per variable, what are the properties? Can I guess that? I mean, there should be something which is self-averaging, and so that's a kind of theoretical question, and it's a theoretical question in which one will want to determine a phase diagram, basically. Where is the sat phase? Where is the unsat phase? What is happening? Now, there is a second kind of question, which is much more algorithmic one, which is, okay, if one is able to identify where is the phase transition and so on, can one devise better algorithm? In some sense, for physicists who have been working on numerical physics, it's reminiscent of a lot of things. I mean, that there will be a phase transition with a critical slowing down. We know that it takes place. We know that also people have devised cluster algorithm when there is critical slowing down. So one can imagine that similar things could happen here. It's not exactly the case, but I will show two examples in these two fields. And so let me, before entering more into the details, I want to give you two results, to state two results. So about the statistical physics of the random 3-sat problem. So it's a problem that has been studied a lot initially by Rémy Monasson, Riccardo Zecchina, and then also with Giulio Biroli and Martin Weicht and so on. And so there has been a lot of work, but what I will really focus on from now on is some recent work that we did with Parisian Zecchina about the phase diagram and then the new algorithm that we devised with Riccardo Zecchina. So the first result is this analytic result about the phase diagram. And what we state is that there are really three phases. And so the threshold, this is again, alpha is the number of constraints per variable, that's for 3-sat. And there is a threshold at alpha c equal 4.267, etc., which is the threshold for satisfiability. It is below this point, a typical sample is sat. It means that there are configurations with satisfiable constraints. Above it, a typical sample is unsat. Typical means almost all samples with probability 1 when n goes to infinity. But the interesting thing is that there is an intermediate phase. It's not only a kind of critical point or something. There is an intermediate phase between 3.9 and 4.3. This intermediate phase in which there are sat configurations, but they are very, very difficult to find. This is called the hard sat phase. And let me try to explain what is the difference between these two phases. Here, it's for alpha small enough, small number of constraints, there is basically only one state. So one state, what do I call a state? Well, basically, the important thing here is what is a minimal energy configuration. I will call a minimal energy configuration is a configuration where I cannot lower the energy by a finite number of spin flips. Okay, that's a very reasonable definition of minimal energy configuration. It means it's locally minimum, but up to any finite size of flipping of the variables. And now, what I call a state is just a connected set, connected set of minimal energy configuration, which are connected to each other by some arbitrary number of spin flips. So they are just all the same energy connected. You can go from one to the other. So here, what I claim is that below this alpha, there is only one state. And then in this intermediate phase, which is a sat phase, but I call it the hard sat phase, there are many states. So there is a clustering which takes place in the space of configuration. Configurations start to cluster. And there are some clusters which are the green clusters. And these are clusters in which the configuration are sat. So here I have a bunch of sat configuration. Actually, there are exponentially many of them. It has some internal entropy. But they are all connected to each other. And here is another one. But I cannot go from a configuration here to there by flipping a finite number of variables. So the solutions start to cluster. And on top of that, there are also basically metastable states, which are configuration which are local minima of the energy, again, stable up to finite number of spin flips, but not with zero energy. They are not sat configuration. And the big problem is that these metastable clusters, there are many more of them than there are good sat clusters. And so any kind of local algorithm, which will start from a point and go locally to the best thing, it will converge to a stable state, and it will not be able to find the solution.
When you talk about being able to go from one configuration to another with a finite number of flips, obviously in a finite system you can always do that.
Yes.
So you're talking about the behavior of the number of flips as the size.
As the size diverges, exactly. Yes. Yes, all that is the analytic result in which one is interested in the thermodynamic limit of the problem. So one important ingredient in all that is what I call the complexity. So the complexity is the following. Here is a definition, recalling the definition of state I have just given, a minimal energy configuration connected by finite flips. And what happens in the Hart-Sat phase is that the number of states diverges exponentially. It diverges like exponential number of variable times a certain function of the energy. And so this function, which is called the complexity function, how does it behave? Well, if I am in the Hart-Sat phase, this function behaves like that. This is sigma as function of energy density. And here you see that there are some states at zero energy. These are the Sat configuration, and their number, the logarithm of the number, is given by this height. But then there are many, many more states with a finite energy, up to this energy, which is called the threshold energy. And so typically here you have an exponentially larger number of states which have this threshold energy. And so all the simple algorithm that you can think of, they will be trapped at this level, this value of the energy. Now, if I increase alpha, what happens is that this curve goes down until I reach the critical value for Sat, in which the zero energy state, they go, their number goes to zero. And then from now on, their number will be zero. And I will still have a complexity curve, but no Sat configuration. So that is the result that we got for the phase diagram. And the thing which is interesting is that elaborating on the method, I will then talk a little bit about the method, but using this method that we used to find this theoretical result, let's say, we have found a new class of algorithm which is able to find, to reach this very rare, in some sense, configuration, Sat configuration, in this difficult region, the Hart-Sat phase. And this new algorithm is a message passing algorithm which is called the survey propagation, and I will try to give you an idea of how it works. So let me now go relatively briefly into a bit more into the problem, and basically there are three main steps that I in the construction. Both I will elaborate in parallel both the theoretical ideas and the algorithm, I mean at a very qualitative level, of course. But so I will start by some simple graphical representation of satisfiability as a random graph. Then in the second stage, I will develop an elementary message passing procedure, which is a good algorithm when there is only a single state at very low value of alpha. And this, I will show you that this is equivalent to the Beto approximation in statistical physics. And then I will turn to the many state situation, the Hart-Sat phase, and I will show you a method called the cavity method, inspired from the cavity method developed in spin glasses. And I will show you how this amounts to pass some more complicated messages, which are actually surveys of the elementary messages. So the first step, is a graphical representation. So that's a very easy step, but it will be very useful to explain how things work. So here is one clause. A clause is built with three variables, for instance, x1 bar or x2 or x3 bar. I denote it by a square. The variables are denoted by a circle. This is variable 1, variable 2, variable 3. This is clause A. It is connected to the variables 1, 2, and 3. And it is connected to variable 2, so that's a full line, variable 1 bar, that's a dashed line, variable 3 bar, that's a dashed line. Basically, what the only thing you have to remember is that to satisfy the clause, I have to have either the variable 2 pointing up, or variable 1 pointing down, or variable 3 pointing down. Any of this is sufficient to satisfy the clause automatically. So some people tend to use also Ising spins, and that's a very simple mapping from Boolean variable to Ising spins, and then you will associate to a clause an energy which is 1 minus S1 over 2, 1 plus S2 over 2, 1 minus S3 over 2. And of course, you will often see, saying that the variable points up or down, and that's not the language of computer scientists, but they tend to understand it all the same. So that's a problem, for instance. That will be a satisfiability problem. It's given by this graph. It's a set of clauses. This one has variable length. I mean, this is a three clause, and so it's given by such a graph.
Mark, what is the dotted line?
The dotted line is just to mention, because you see, in a clause, it's not always the variable itself which arrives in a clause. Otherwise, it would be easy to satisfy because you put everybody to one and it's satisfied. But sometimes there is a variable which appears negated. So the dashed line is to say this variable appears negated. So it means that this variable, in order to satisfy the clause, it should point down. That's just a graphical way to see things. Now let us look at the random three-sat problem. So what the random three-sat problem, it is built of clauses like that with three legs. And what I have to do is I pick up a set of variables and I put my clauses at random. And now what I claim is that the random three-sat problem, it has the geometry which is locally tree-like. It's a three-spin interaction because each clause is connected to three spin. But you will it's a easy probabilistic computation to do to see that if this variable and this variable belong to the same clause, then they have very small probability to belong to another clause, actually about a 1 over n. So it means that basically the graph locally looks like a tree. It has some loops. But if you look at the typical size of a loop, it will grow like log n. That's easy to find out. It's like the structure of random Erdős-Reényi graph. I mean, so that is very interesting. And also, I should mention, it's easy to find what is the probability that a given variable here will have a certain connectivity. It is a Poisson-distributed variable with mean 3 alpha, where alpha is always the number of constraints per variable. So because this graph is locally tree-like, it makes it possible to use some kind of iterative method. That is, if it would be a full tree, then that one could use the better approximation, the better solution, let's say, that is propagating things from the boundary of the tree to the center. And one knows how to solve statistical mechanics problem on the tree. And so basically, that's what we will do. And the first approximation that I will show you is assume that it is a tree, see what one finds. And then I will show you the effect of the loops. And the effect of the loops means it will make it more difficult to solve. But one will have to introduce these surveys because of the loop. So it makes it possible to use iterative methods to solve the statistical physics problem, but also to use as an algorithm. And these are what are called message passing methods.
The example you have on the previous transparency is completely loop.
Yes, the previous example, but it was so small that it is difficult for, if I show a small example like that,
right. So
that is just too small.
Yeah. Okay.
But you see, we are working with systems of thousands and tens of thousands of variables. So
the large numbers are, these loops are rather small.
Sorry?
These loops are actually rather small.
Yes. But let me start with the idea that let me first of all neglect them, and then I will come back to their effect. And taking into account this effect is the main thing that we had to do, of course. So let me first discuss the algorithm, an algorithm which is called which is a simple message passing algorithm which is called belief propagation, and belief propagation is an algorithm that is used by people who are doing error correcting codes. When you decode a message you have encoded for error correction, decoding it is an optimization problem, right? That is finding the original message. It's an optimization problem which looks pretty much like the one that we are dealing with now. And people have used a method in this field which is called, it's a very nice name, it's belief propagation. And in physics, when, as I will argue later, when we'll call it probably iterate, iterative solution of a Bethe equation or something like that. But belief propagation is much nicer, so I have adopted it. So let me explain to you this in this case in simple terms. So here is a clause. This clause, it is connected to three variables. Now, this clause will send a message. This clause A will send a message to variable 1. This message will be the form of a warning. It can be either a warning or no warning. That is, it's a binary type message. So if it is a warning, it will say to variable 1, look, be careful, I need you to point in the direction that will make me happy. That's the kind of warning that it will send. So here, for instance, to satisfy clause A, it will say, look, you need to point up. So how does it decide to send such a warning? It decides to send such a warning by looking at the other two variables and looking at the messages that come to the other two variables. So let's see here variable 2. It is connected to some other clauses, and it receives some messages from the other clauses. Some of these messages are just no warning. So this, it does not take them into account. There is no problem with these messages. But here, for instance, this variable has received a message 1. It means along this side, it has received a warning. This warning, because it is a full line, it meant that the clause up there warned the variable 2 and said the variable 2, you should point up. So this is one message received. Another one here tells it to point up. So this variable wants to point up. If this variable wants to point up, it will not satisfy the clause here. Now, variable 3, again, it receives two warnings from people telling him to point down. If it points down, it will not satisfy the clause. So in this set of incoming messages up there, the clause A will not be satisfied either by 2 or by 3, and in such a case, it will send a warning. Okay? Of course.
So there are two kinds of warning. Does each clause can do nothing, send no warning, or send two kinds up or down?
Well, yes, but the sign of the warning is always determined by the sign of the line here. If it is a warning, it means point in the direction which satisfies me.
Oh, okay.
You never want to tell something to point in the direction that doesn't
send. No. And of course, there is a converse case in which. Here, for instance, the variable 2 has received a warning telling him to point down. Mm-hmm. If it points down, it will satisfy clause A. So independently of what happens up there, there will be no warning sent to 1. Okay. So that's very easy. Then one can start from a graph and iterate these messages. And it turns out that this method converges and gives the correct answer if you look at a satisfiability problem on the tree. It's very easy to prove that. Yes, but you start anywhere, but the information will propagate from the edge of the tree because it will be fixed from the edge of the tree and then propagate. And so it converges in polynomial time. So that's very easy. Actually, the thing which is interesting is that there is a direct statistical physics analog, and this had been noted in the framework of error correcting code, in particular by Jonathan Yedidia and co-workers, who found out that really all this belief propagation is equivalent to the better approximation for a problem. So how does it work? If I look at this problem from a statistical physics point of view, and I have my three variables, I have a local Boltzmann weight, which is the energy of the clause, minus the field acting of S1 from the outside, the field acting of S2 from the outside, and the field acting of S3 from the outside. So imagine that I build a cavity here, and I cut all the input from the bottom to variable 1, and I look at what happens for the other two variables. So now I can trace over variable S2 and S3, and I can look at the probability in this cavity of a given value of the spin S1. This is given by the sum of S2 of S3 of the Boltzmann weight. And this means that this cavity probability of S1, I can, because it's a Boolean variable, I can write it as e to the minus beta, a local field times S1. And this local field is a function of H2 and A3. It's very easy to compute because I may have to sum four terms, okay? So this is just a local field, which is the local field sent from this pair of variables to one through the clause. And now, of course, if you start to build this local field, then you can close the whole scheme by introducing so here, this is the local field resulting from this clause here. I will have from another clause another local field, another one, and so on. This I called cavity bias. Well, it doesn't matter the name. And the total field seen by variable 1 in the absence of clause B, for instance, will be the set of all the sum of all these influences from all the other fields. So then here you see that I have closed the problem because I have computed the local field on 1 in the absence of B as a function of the local field on 2 in the absence of A, the local field of 3 in the absence of A, and so on. So I have a closed set of equations for local cavity fields. And that's just the Betheuer approximation. And this Betheuer approximation, it's exactly the same thing as the message passing procedure that I was seeing before. So in some sense, the belief propagation, you can see it as a kind of mean field approximation, in which basically what you do is that you cut a little bit here. You say, imagine that the clause A was not here. Then I have a local field on 2, a local field on 3. Now if I know all this local field, I can compute the local field on 1 in the absence of B. And I have a self-consistent set of equations like that. And that's what I am doing. So I told you it works on a tree, and of course, does it work or not on a system with loops? Well, that's the whole issue, and it must work. This is this belief propagation or Betheuer approximation. It works only if one can neglect the correlation between the input fields. This is what I did here. I was supposing that the fields are independent variables coming from the exterior. And because random free set is locally tree-like, it means that generically the two spins S2 and S3, which send the messages, they are very far away if I suppress the clause to which I am looking at, a distance of order log n. So as they are very far away, it's a good assumption to assume that they will be uncorrelated. But this is true only if there is a single pure state. If you have a phase in which you have many states, even far away variables will become correlated. They are correlated only inside one state. So the thing that one has to do, so this actual belief propagation algorithm or Betheuer approximation, it works only in the easy set phase, alpha less than alpha d. It's wrong in the hard set phase because of the proliferation of local ground states, stable to finite number of spin flips. And so it is this state proliferation, this exponential number of states, which ruins this as an algorithm and also as a theoretical device. So what does one have to do in the case in which there are many states? Well, the problem is the following. You see, this message propagation, belief propagation, it expresses a local equilibrium of variable. Looking at the neighborhood, it will equilibrate in the local field. But of course, if you have a system with several states, you may have a local equilibration here in one state, a local equilibration in this other part of the graph in another state. But then, when the message come together, if they are not in the same state, you get a contradiction. And the result is that it does not converge. So one has to do something else. And the something else was to go to something that is called survey propagation. And in the survey propagation, one will introduce a more complicated message, and the message will be a survey of the elementary messages in the states at a fixed energy density. So, as I told you, this UA to 1 was one of the messages. It was 0 if there is no warning, or 1 if there is a warning. Now I can look at all the possible states of the program at a given energy, and look at the histogram of all the messages in these states at this given energy. Okay. This gives me a function Q of U. It's a bit of a complicated object because U is only a binary variable, 0, 1. The probability of U is given by a single number, so it's not such a complicated thing. And now the thing that I will do is that I will propagate these surveys along the graph. So let me try to give an idea of how this works. So I go back to my clause. And now, here is how it will work. So eta will be the probability that a warning has been sent. And so here I will, that characterizes the survey. So here along this link, I have a certain survey. I have a certain probability eta that a message, a warning has been sent. Here also I have another eta and so on. Here I have some messages eta prime. So now this guy will transfer a probability, which is the probability that it will point in the wrong direction. Okay, this probability is easily computed. I mean, this is the sketch of the formula. This guy will give the probability that it points down, which is the wrong direction. And then the probability of having a warning here is just P times Q. And that's it. I mean, that's basically the idea of the survey propagation. And the amazing thing is that this algorithm converges in the Hardsat phase. And as an algorithm, but I should say that before looking at it as an algorithm, we really used it as a theoretical tool, because you can compute the statistics of this eta, compute the probability distribution of this eta, and when you have this, it's easy to compute all the thermodynamics of the problem and get the phase diagram. So using this idea, one can both develop an algorithm and and develop the phase diagram. So this is an account of the phase diagram. So again, this is the alpha d, this is the easy sat phase, the hard sat phase. This is E naught, is the minimal number of violated clause. It is the quantity that I was referring to before. It's zero here, and it starts linearly here. And then here is sigma, is the complexity of the ground states, that is the state with the zero energy. So here I know that when I go closer to alpha c, there are less and less states of zero energy. It's more difficult to find them, and it vanishes exactly at alpha c. And the threshold energy is the energy at which I have the largest number of states, which is the energy where I will get trapped if I run a local algorithm, let's say. So that's for the phase diagram. And now, how does one use that as an algorithm? Because I mean, the algorithm works as follows. I can iterate these messages, which are the surveys. Once I iterate the messages, I can look locally on one variable, and this variable, it will receive, I will have a certain probability that it receives some warnings. That is, I will compute a local field hi on this variable, which is the sum of the warning, and what I have is a probability distribution on these warnings. Okay, and these guys, and there will be warnings telling it to point up, warnings telling it to point down. So I have a whole histogram of local fields, and then I have a signature on each variable. And there are some variables which are special. For instance, there are variables which are completely biased, in which most of the warnings tell them, most of the warnings which have some non-zero weight tell it to point up. So this is a very biased variable. There are other variables which are completely balanced, the equal weight between positive H and negative H. And so the idea of what we call survey-inspired decimation is just to look at these local fields, look at the probability density, so it's on the integers. We have a probability distribution on the integers, and we have a way to identify the most biased variables, the one in which this probability distribution is shifted the most to the right, for instance. And I will take this variable and make it point up. And then once it points up, of course, there are some clauses which are satisfied by the way that it points up, so I erase these clauses. There are other clauses which are not satisfied. They were three clauses with three variables. They become clauses with two variables. And I have a new graph. On this new graph, I run again the survey propagation algorithm, and I iterate this construction. And I decimate my sample. So now here is a curve of the complexity as a function of the number of violated clause. For a sample, I guess it was a sample with 10,000 variables. So here I am speaking of the complexity of one given sample. Because I mean, the same equation that I use for computing the complexity average of a sample and so on, I can use it numerically. I have all the local surveys. With all the local surveys, I can compute the complexity. This was the complexity curve of my sample. So it means that when I had run before any decimation, my guess was that there would be exponential of 35 clusters with zero energy, satisfied clusters, but exponential of 210 clusters with 42 violated clues. So that was my initial problem. Now I start to decimate it. And here it is the decimation. Every 200 decimation, I plot the new complexity that I have for the sample. And so I see that the complexity, it decreases, but the threshold energy decreases and so on, until I get to a point here in which I have no threshold energy. The complexity is still not zero. And so here I can solve this. Here my problem has been reduced. It has about half of the number of variables that it had initially. And here I can solve it by any stupid algorithm. I mean, it has become completely trivial because all the clusters have collapsed. So this decimation process, we showed first, when we first found that, we went to the benchmark. I mean, there is a lot of activity on SAT for many years. So we solved we looked at the largest benchmark, which are size 1,000 and 2,000 on the SATlib site. But then we found out that we could solve them, and then we started to generate our own samples. And we are able, in the hardsat phase, deep in the hardsat phase at alpha equal 4.2, we are able to solve samples of 10 to the 7 clauses, 10 to the 7 variable, 4 10 to the 7 clauses. And the complexity is very small. It increases only like n log n. So, I mean, we could go beyond that, but then, okay. So then we found out that the best available algorithm, which is the 35th version of WorkSat by Selman, stops around n equal a few 10 to the 4. So, I mean, that's a big progress. Of course, I mean, this is one strategy that we use, but maybe there are other ones, and certainly there are other ones. That is, in fact, the problem is that all these histograms, these surveys of local fields, it contains an enormous lot of information on our problem. And then one can exploit it, one can think of exploiting it in various cases. And here I have just shown one version, one example of a use of that. Just in 1 minute, I would like to make a small digression on glasses, because you may think that there was a glass in my title and I have not talked about glasses at all. Well, in fact, if you look at glass formation in system with short-range repulsion, like, for instance, hard sphere, the main ingredient is geometric frustration. That is, locally, you would like to pile the spheres, and you have a local icosahedral order. But of course, this order cannot propagate throughout the space. So one way of modeling that, I mean, just to mention one model, which is in some sense rather intimately, which has some connection with the previous one I was discussing. One way of discussing that is looking at some lattice glass model in which, in this region of space, I have a variable which is 1 if it is dense, if it is a rather dense packing here, or 0 if it is not dense. And geometric frustration will just mean that if I have a dense packing here, I cannot have a dense packing all around there. That is, I have a density constraint in this coarse grain variable. And this is what we call the lattice glass model. That's a model we introduced with Giulio Biroli. And actually, if you look at this model and solve it in the better approximation, you find that it has three phases, a phase which is liquid, a phase in which it becomes many states, that is, there are many ways of putting this, but it builds some clusters, and then a phase with a static transition where a few states dominate. And if you look at it numerically on a 3D lattice, it exhibits all the nice relaxation, two-step relaxation in time that are seen in glasses. So I think that there is much more connection than it may look. So just to conclude, well, it's possible using this method to obtain some analytic result on the generic samples of random 3SAT, like the phase diagram. The slowdown of algorithm near to alpha C is due to the existence of a hard SAT phase, and this hard SAT phase, it has clustering of the satisfiable configuration. And the slowdown is due to an exponential number of states in this intermediate phase. It turns out that the whole construction can be checked versus rigorous computation in one simpler problem, which is the random XORSAT problem. And then if you go to single sample analysis, the same technique, which is this cavity method that initially was used to solve for the phase diagram, applying the cavity method on a single sample leads you to this survey propagation, which converges and yields a non-trivial information on the sample. It tells you for each site, it gives you a certificate of everything which is arriving on this site from very far away in the form of a probability distribution. And using this information in a very naive way, actually, one can work out, for instance, a decimation scheme, which turns out to be a very efficient algorithm for solving three-sat problems. And similar things have been developed also by various people on coloring. For instance, Martin Veit, who is here, has worked on that. And this mechanism that I was showing here is also involved in the generation of long relaxation times in glasses. Okay, thank you very much.
Can you speak louder?
Yes.
Are there problems which with reasonable Hadoop institutional inputs do state typically handling problems?
Well, that's a very good question. Actually, what is happening here, what we have shown is that we can go very close to the unsatisfiability threshold, and we have a polynomial and actually n log n algorithm which solves the problem here. Still, then there are several possibilities. One possibility would be that the whole random three-sat problem is typically polynomial. This might be one possibility. It would be a bit surprising. But this I don't know yet, because, I mean, one thing that we have not yet done, but we are working on that, is to work on the other side of the transition, that is in the unsat phase. In the unsat phase, it's more difficult, because then you have to provide, showing that the system is sat, it's easy at least to check, because you give the configuration and you see if it works or not. Showing that it is not sat, you have to show that there is a contradiction. And this will be a much more difficult task. I'm convinced that the use of the surveys in this phase will also be useful for that. I'm working on that, but we have not done it. So it's still, we have still not made progress on the other side of the phase diagram, which is beyond alpha c. And so I don't know. I don't know exactly what will be the schedule. But there are some problems in which if one would be able to show that they are typically polynomial, then one would show that p is equal to np. So, well, that would be very interesting.
So you have this phase transition when energy is equal to zero on one side and is non-zero on the other side. And you study it in thermodynamic limit when n goes to infinity. What does it mean, zero? Zero in this transition point. Is it exactly zero, or is something which is not proportional to the system size? And could there be an interval where energy is not zero but is not proportional to
certain energy? Very probably, yes. I mean, here we have been in the analytic part, we have been computing only thermodynamic quantities, so I have access only to the extensive part of the energy. So when I say that the energy is zero in my computation, I know only that the extensive part of the energy is zero. So I can use that rigorously. I could use these methods to provide some bounds, but not to really pin the alpha, if I want to be rigorous.
One constraint of even limit n to infinity is still a solution.
Sorry, can you state that again?
When you manage to satisfy all restrictions except one,
yes,
but total number of them turns to infinity.
The threshold will be the same.
Yeah.
That's my yes.
But when you actually use your algorithm to solve the 10 to the 7 variable.
Yes.
Sample,
yes.
Did you actually get zero?
Ah, right? Zero is zero. Oh, yes, yes. I, one cannot cheat with that. No, no, no. Satisfiable means satisfiable. That's zero.
Yes. But it means that this. Yes.
So, no, certainly one could zoom on this point, and zooming on this point, taking some alpha minus alpha c times n to some power, then we will get an energy of a certain. I'm sure that there are interesting things around that point, but it's not known at the moment.
Questions? David?
All the other problems can be mapped to three set points,
yes.
Polynomial problems.
Yes.
So, also for the random problems? And if so, does that mean that you can use this algorithm to polynomially solve the hard problems?
Okay, so, I mean, the algorithm, it works very well on the random 3-sat. It does not mean that it works automatically for any sat problem. And in fact, we are working on that also. I mean, we have problems with the samples in which we have many very small loops. But this is something that, in principle, one should be able to pre-process, because if you have a small loop, you just renormalize it in some sense. I mean, you can introduce an effective variable which will swallow the loop, and so that's what we are doing at the moment. It turns out that the thing which is very interesting is that all these SAT things and so on, the applications, they come around 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 variables, but not of a random 3-sat necessarily. So, I mean, so far we have not yet found the right application, let's say, for instance, we have been working on you can describe the problem of factoring integers as a satisfiability problem. So we worked a little bit on that. Without doing anything, running the survey propagation on it, it did not, one case we studied, it did not converge. But I mean, then we have to go more into the details to see what is the structure of small loops and so on. But I mean, it gives a lot of work actually to try to do that for practical problems. You see, the problem is that it's not obvious that it will work for any SAT problem, especially because it was invented with this idea in the back of the mind that the loops should be not too small and not too frequent. It's true that when we have a sample of 3-sat with 1,000 variables, there are plenty of small loops. I mean, the log n is not that big, and so, but it still works for some reason. But it works much better for 10 to the 7 than for 10 to the 3. Because of this fact that there are less small loops. So in fact, that's one thing that for computer scientists, it's a bit of an obstacle, because generally we give them the survey propagation and they try it on their favorite sample and it has 500 variables and it's a bit too small. So sometimes it does not work. Just for this stupid reason that something that we have not implemented yet, that is to renormalize the small loops. And we know how to do it, but it's algorithmically it's a bit tedious to program.
But if you took something like traveling salesman, you could also map it onto it.
The decision problem we can map onto it, yes. But if you solve the decision problem with various value of the energies, then you are in business. So basically,
again, the algorithm should be mappable.
Yes, in principle it is. Well, in practice, you see, it's more like a theoretical construction most of the time. These polynomial mappings, in general, it generates a lot more variable than what you would need, even if it is polynomial. So it may not be the best way. The best way, I think, is to use the idea of survey propagation, which is this idea of surveys of elementary messages, develop them for each individual case, rather than mapping. Unless we really come with someone which does the 10 to the 12 variables in all cases.
But German salesman, you see a way of mapping that onto a tree with big loops.
Well, I've not thought about that.
Question?
Yeah. In this picture of the number of states are given to energy, in the unsat phase that had a hard gap.
Yes.
Is it obvious why it's a hard gap and not that? Is there some tail which disappears when that
happens? Well, what it means is that, the thing that may happen in this regime, I mean, the generic sample will have a ground state energy which is extensive. That's the gap, and that's correct. Now, the thing that will happen is that you have exponentially rare samples which have a lower energy than the one which is predicted by this thing. But these are very rare samples. It would be very nice to be able to identify them, actually. They are thermodynamically rare. It's the minus n something. That's awesome. Yes.
Okay, well, let's thank the speaker again.